everyone. You're listening to Confess Radio, brought to you by Confess Global Community Film Festival. I'm your host, Sandy DeFreitas. Over the next few weeks, we will be addressing topics around the civil rights movement, focusing on the impact. Today, we will discuss the article, Who Were the White Knights of the Civil Rights Movement?, written by James M. Russell. This article can be found on our website at www.confess.com. That's C-O-M-M-F-F-E-S-T.com. Our guests today are James Russell, author and filmmaker, and Norman Otis Richmond, broadcast. Good afternoon, gentlemen. How are you?
How are you doing?
Fine, how are you?
Okay, let's talk about the earlier white knights of the civil rights movement of the 50s and the 60s. What impact did it have on change in the conditions of the African Americans?
The white knights, I think, were Huey P. Newton and the Black Panther Party, because they assembled a group of men and women, because the Black Panther Party Huey Newton was supposedly the leader, but they had cadres. They had women like Elaine Brown, Kathleen Cleaver, Tupac's mother, and also you had people like General Gordon Baker in the League of Revolutionary Black Workers, which I was a part of, in Detroit, and his wife, Marion Creamer, and, the Black Panther Party, women were in the leadership, but in the leadership of the League of Revolutionary Black Workers, it was completely men. We were very chauvinistic at that particular time. But, the middle class capitalized on the momentum, and they got the jobs, they got the professorships, and the people that, really, the white knights really were demonized, and Huey died, Huey was killed, and, he had a PhD, but he couldn't find work, he couldn't get work, and other people came forward and, got all of the credit. That's how I see it.
Mm-hmm. Now, there was also a student nonviolent coordinator committee. What impact did the Black Panthers movement have on that?
It's the other way around. The SNCC, Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee, really started the Black Panther Party in Lowndes County, Alabama. And that was people like, his name is Mukasa, but Willie Ricks. He might be out of Chattanooga, Tennessee. And he and Stokely Carmichael, who became Kwame Ture, they were in Mississippi, and they hollered Black Power first. And Richard Wright, who was a writer, talked about Black Power in a book in 1954. But Willie Ricks and Kwame Ture, they started the first Black Panther Party. And Fannie Lou Hamer, the woman Fannie Lou Hamer was at the Democratic Convention, she was made the statements, "We're sick and tired of being sick and tired." Mm-hmm. They really were that's where the Panthers really started from, Alabama.
Samuel, when I think of the civil rights movement and the white knights, I think more of the people who were in the trenches, the people going back further than 64 when the Civil Rights Act was passed. I go back to 55 when Rosa Parks refused to sit at the back of the bus. I go back to the year after that when there was the bus boycott in Montgomery, Alabama. I go back, when I think of the white knights, I think of all those young men and women, both black and white, who sat at the lunch counters and allowed people to pour syrup and ketchup on them. I think of the people who participated in the freedom rides who were attacked, abused, and sometimes killed. When we think of the white knights, I don't necessarily think of the Martin Luther Kings and the Malcolm X's and the Medgar Evers. I think of the people whose names we don't know, but who worked so hard to bring about the passage of the Civil Rights Act in 1964.
Like the unsung heroes. And can you name one or two of those others?
There are a lot. I guess what's unique about them is that their names weren't reported in the media, and what's unique about them is that they did their job, whatever it was, whether it be riding on the buses or sitting in the lunch counters or doing whatever was necessary to oppose the segregationists, and then they went back to their daily lives. Those are the White Knights. You know, I have the greatest respect for the leaders whose names we recognize, but behind those leaders, there were thousands of unnamed men and women.
One of those organizations, another one, is the Revolutionary Action Movement. Are you familiar with that movement?
Revolutionary Action Movement started by Maxwell Curtis Stanford Jr. Yeah, I'm very familiar. I was never a member of the Revolutionary Action Movement. However, I'm very familiar with Muhammad Ahmed, Max Stanford. I know him personally, and I was with him for many, many years. And the Revolutionary Action Movement was started, I think, in Tennessee, and Max Stanford was from still in the land of living, but he was from Philadelphia. He went to Cuba with General Baker, who was one of the founders of the League of Revolutionary Black Workers, and they met Robert Williams. And, you know, General Baker was married, this sister by the name of Marion Kramer, and the Revolutionary Action Movement was an underground movement, and they were, J. Edgar Hoover said that they were a highly secret all-Negro Marxist and this terrorist group, which advocates guerrilla warfare to obtain its goals. And Max Stanford was one of the people that they said was the most dangerous man in America. But the Revolutionary Action Movement has been written out of history. And the Revolutionary Action Movement was really, there was a woman by the name of Queen Mother Moore. She was from New Orleans, Louisiana. She was a Garveyite, then she joined the Communist Party. She influenced Max Stanford, and Max Stanford was really influenced by a lot of women. He has a book out, See You in the Whirlwind, but the Revolutionary Action Movement was, there were men and women who did that, and they've basically been written out of history. I'm surprised that you even mentioned them, because they have been really, like, written out of history.
What kind of influence did they have in the civil rights movement back then? How powerful were they?
Revolutionary. Well, Max Stanford went to Mississippi. He was run out of Mississippi. And they basically worked through other organizations. And, you know, they claim that in terms of the whole Black Power movement, they were the ones that really pushed SNCC to cry Black Power. That's one of their claim to fame. But James Foreman was, he marched with Martin Luther King. If you see the films of James Foreman, pictures of what is the famous march? Selma, Alabama. Mm-hmm. James Foreman is standing next to Dr. Martin Luther King. James Foreman used to be in the League of Revolutionary Black Workers. And James Foreman, I used to know James Foreman used to criticize me sometimes for reading the Detroit News. He told me to read the New York Times. But anyway, James Foreman said that Max Stanford told him that we have to talk more about socialism as opposed to, you know, the whole question of civil rights. I mean, they were way, way, way ahead of their time.
Right.
Yes, we should talk about socialism, and mm-hmm. we should be anti-capitalist as opposed to just, we have to be different from the Nation of Islam, because the Nation of Islam, the contribution that they made, they were basically a Black sort of a pro-capitalist type of outfit, and that's mm-hmm. one of the reasons why Malcolm split with them.
Mm-hmm. Sandy, anytime you talk about organizations like RAM or the Panthers, or what was the Nation of Islam's military arm?
Fruit of Islam.
The Fruit of Islam. They're the stick.
Mm-hmm.
And any social movement needs a stick, and they need a carrot. Mm-hmm. Martin Luther King was the carrot. and organizations that were more inclined toward military actions or physical action were the stick. And you need both in order to move any large group such as the American government or the segregationists or the Republican Party. You need the carrot and the stick, because the stick drives them toward the carrot. And that essentially is what the Civil Rights Act of 1964 was, the carrot.
Could I piggyback on that? I agree with Jim, because everybody talks about Mahatma Gandhi and his nonviolent situation, but Mahatma Gandhi had behind him some of those Indians, yeah, some of the most militant human beings on the planet Earth, and they were ready to tear the place up.
Right.
And Gandhi was the carrot, but the Indians definitely had a stick. I mean, the Indians, when black people in America were fighting for their rights, some of the first people to support African people in America and African people in South Africa and African people in the Caribbean were the Indians. The Indian government was 1948.
Right.
They came out and spoke in the United Nations and talked about.
And we, let me just explain. When we say Indians,
we're talking about India. India.
Okay.
India, the country of India. Right. Okay. We're talking Nehru.
Yes.
Yeah.
I want to just touch upon one of the philosophies of the Revolution Action Movement. They wanted to adopt the philosophy of Maoism. Can you speak on that?
Mao Zedong was very, very, very popular in some circles. I grew up in Los Angeles, California, and we were influenced by Mao Zedong. Now, we had the Communist Party, we had the Nation of Islam, and we had the other civil rights movement, but we gravitated towards China because, to be perfectly honest, at that particular time, we saw black and white. At that time, when I say we, I was a race man. At that particular time, well, I'm still a race man, but I saw race only at one time.
Mm-hmm.
And race, and Chinese, Mao Zedong was supposedly a Marxist, he was a Marxist-Leninist, but he was a yellow man. Ho Chi Minh was a yellow man, so we gravitated towards the Chinese. And then Robert F. Williams went to Cuba, and after he left Cuba, well, first of all, Robert Williams was a civil rights leader from Monroe, North Carolina, who was run out of North Carolina because he was protecting a white couple. There was a shootout. They were shooting out of power to police and protect this white couple. He escaped to Toronto, came to Canada, then he went to Cuba, stayed in Cuba for a while, then he went to China. And Mao Zedong made statements in support of the African Liberation Movement, two statements. So therefore, we were really, Mao was some of us.
Right.
And of course, the Communist Party supported the Soviet Union, and there was a big split between the pro-Moscow people and the pro-Chinese people. And Walter Rodney, eventually my position became the same as Walter Rodney's. It's like I would deal with the Chinese and the Russians. That was just my personal position. But Maoism was very popular in some elements of the Black Liberation Movement in the United States.
When I was selling the newspaper of the Black Panther Party in the streets of Berkeley, I always used to have a copy of
Red Book.
The Red Book in my back pocket.
You
know. Oh, yes. Oh, yes.
Out of those different movements came a Southern Christian Leadership Conference. It seemed to be a more toned-down organization. Would you say that?
It was more Christian.
Right.
Which by nature is toned down, because religion tends to be I wanted to use a stronger word than moderator. it guts small social movements. Christians are not known for their revolutionary zeal, unless it's against other religions. I sort of think of them in the similar vein as the NAACP. And I think a lot of them, their members were, in fact, members of both.
This was led when the lead, under the leadership of Martin Luther King Jr.
Yeah, but I think that we have to remember that Martin Luther King in 1967 was public enemy number one for J. Edgar Hoover. King was the most. There was a civil rights movement in the Black Power situation, but the Southern Christian Leadership Conference, like I said when I was we were speaking earlier, some of us saw Dr. King at that time as a big Uncle Tom. But in 1967, he made this speech in Riverside Church, New York, where he came out against the triple militarism and he came out against the war in Vietnam,
yeah.
And at that time, J. Edgar Hoover was sending tapes to his wife and saying he should kill himself. And from April, he made that speech on April 4th, 1967. And from April 4th until he was killed on April 4th, 1968, as far as J. Edgar Hoover was, he was public enemy number one.
Right.
While we were criticizing him in the movement for being this and being that, the state singled him out and went after him. And even some people in his own organization distanced himself from him because he talked about the international situation. Because King says, look, you know, those Indians, when I say people from India, from China, and from all over the world, Indonesia, they're supporting us, and they're not our enemy.
Right.
Yeah.
So you say back then that the African Americans were trying to form allegiance with different politics around the world to help uplift them?
No, I think it was sort of a maturing of the movement. It starts off very local with the concerns that you're having with your local police and your local politicians. But after a while, you mature and you start thinking about the bigger picture.
Mm-hmm.
And you realize that injustice is not something that's specific to America.
Right.
So I think that I don't know whether we at the time were looking for alliances, but it doesn't hurt to have friends in high places. Whether they be China or Cuba or the Soviet Union, especially when you're confronted with a behemoth like the American government and the American police and the American National Guard.
Mm-hmm. Well, you know, Christoph was in Augusta, Georgia. Not Augusta, Georgia. He was in Savannah, Georgia. You know, America always, when they always talked about, you know, the South Africans called in the communists to help them. But America, during the American Revolution, the Americans had people from Haiti, from all over the world, who helped them win the American Revolution.
Right.
French. So, I mean, the Haitians were the example for, the Haitians were the example for all of us in terms of the international support. You know, the Haitians were really the people that helped free the whole world.
Like a catalyst
to
freedom.
For everybody.
Mm-hmm. And now they seem to be suffering for it.
Well, that's exactly why they're suffering. Mm-hmm. They never will forgive Haiti for Dessaline. Oh my God, I wanted to name my son Dessaline, and I said to myself,
Toussaint Louverture.
Yeah, but I'm gonna say Dessaline was the one. Toussaint died in prison, right?
Yeah,
remember?
Sure.
And Dessaline led them to freedom, and they hated Dessaline because Dessaline was like their at that Malcolm X, Martin Luther King type
right,
of thing.
Right.
When we talk about the civil rights movement of the 50s and the 60s and leading into today, how many others, you know, benefited from the civil rights movement outside of the African American
society?
Oh, lots. The Chicano community benefited. Cesar Chavez came out of that same period, and rights for the Mexican workers who were being exploited in the fields of California. Voting rights, the fact that the voting rights were, the restrictions were loosened, benefit not only blacks, but also whites, Chicanos, as well as Chinese and Japanese. So a lot of minorities benefited from the civil rights movement.
And would you say the women's movement also?
And the women's movement as well, because some of the restrictions that, the same restrictions that affected blacks were also affecting women in terms of voting and in terms of access to
employment,
social programs, those kinds of restrictions were against women as well.
Mm-hmm. So not only the civil rights movement became a catalyst for the African American community, but it was a kind of a global movement altogether. Everybody benefited from it.
Yes, but I think that the black people in America benefited from the global movement, supported the African American movement, because if it hadn't been for, first of all, black people in America defended themselves, but had it not been for the international support, I think me and Jim wouldn't be sitting here today. I think we would have been wiped out. That's my personal position, because there was a place called the Soviet Union, and there was a socialist bloc. There was China, there was Cuba, there was Africa, mm-hmm. and they were looking at America, and they couldn't do certain things because the eye of the world was looking at them, and that sort of, that was Dr. King's, that was the King's strategy. Because what's his name? This guy named Al Bell, mm-hmm. who owned Stack Records. Yeah, Al Bell, he had Stack Records. He told me that he marched with Dr. Martin Luther King. Now, Al Bell is about 6'6". And he said he marched with Dr. King, and they were walking down the street marching, and the white folks calling him all kind of names, you know, the N-word, the this, the that. And he said that don't bother him. But he said a white guy spit on him. And Al Bell, being 6'6" and weighing about 220 pounds, he decked the white guy. And Martin Luther King told him, he said, look, he said, this is our movement. Is we're about trying to get publicity. It's like you go join Marcus Garvey and them guys. It's like he wasn't opposed to him doing what he did, but he basically said, this is a tactical thing. We're trying to get cameras. And so it's like we're going to take these butt kickings because we're going to get the Chinese, the Russians, the whole world is filming this, and this is going to benefit us. And you punching this white guy out. It's like, you know, basically, I'm not saying you're wrong, but I'm just saying tactically, we are trying to get publicity. So you decking this white dude kind of makes us kind of look bad. So it's like, you know, Al, go join Stokely and those folks. And he said it was very amiable, but he basically said it's, the script says we have to do certain such and such because our objective is to get publicity.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So well, he knew exactly what he was doing.
The whole idea of the publicity, I mean, the having cops turn water hoses on protesters who were nonviolent really played well in the Soviet Union and in Cuba and in China. So America lost a lot of prestige, just as America is losing prestige when someone whips out a cell phone and starts filming a cop shooting an unarmed black person. You're taking it to the social media. And back then, the social media was the news organizations the Communist Party, the Chinese Communist Party, the Cuban media, if you can take it international,
mm-hmm.
then you gain clout. And clout,
right.
And clout's important.
There was one thing I wanted to say about the women, and the women of the movement, civil rights movement, and the Black Power movement really excluded women. And, you know, the whole question of, like, Black Lives Matter, I think, was formed by women. And I think one of the reasons why the women have always been at the forefront, but they have been marginalized by male chauvinism. At the March on Washington, there were two women on stage. It was Mahalia Jackson and it was Odetta from L.A.
Right.
And it was a male-dominated thing. Malcolm used to talk about women so bad. The women used to complain and would write Mr. Muhammad and say, you know, Malcolm said this about women. Malcolm said that, da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da. You know, basically telling him to shut up, you know, because he was very, very hard on women.
Right.
And then he went traveled and said, you know, women have to be part of the movement. Otherwise, we're not going to be free. But I think that 2017, I think we're seeing the emergence of, not the emergence, like I said, the women have always been there, but I think women are finally getting their due.
We have some notable examples, Angela Davis and Kathleen Cleaver.
Mm-hmm.
And in Canada, we had the lady from Montreal. What was her name?
Desmond.
Viola Desmond?
Viola Desmond?
No. Afro, large Afro. She was involved in the...
Brenda Dash.
Brenda Dash? Was it Brenda Dash? Anyway, there was...
Does she look like Angela? Does she look like...
Yeah.
That was Brenda Dash.
Brenda Dash?
Yes.
Okay.
Brenda Dash, right.
Yeah, and she was amazing, and she was in that period of the late 60s and early 70s that grew out of the university when they destroyed the computers in Montreal.
St. George Williams
affair.
Right.
Yes.
Why do you think some of those old movements fell by the wayside, that only the few stood up today? You know, you've got NAACP, of course, you've got, Black Panther's no longer, but you have...
UNIA's gone. Well, mostly gone.
Right. Why didn't they stand the test of time?
There was a thing called the gun. I mean, if you stood up, you got killed, you went to prison, you were chasing the exile. Plain and simple.
Yeah, I think some of them accomplished their goals. Social movements are not static things. You know, they tend to change and morph. And if you build your organization on a specific set of goals and you achieve those goals mostly,
mm-hmm.
Then it's time to move on.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that a lot of those organizations just reach the end of their natural lives.
A lifespan.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. And now today we have the Black Lives Matter. We mentioned it briefly. What are your thoughts on this movement and how it pertains to today?
Well, I think the Black Lives Matter movement is like Occupy. It's an amorphous movement. We have some genuine revolutionaries, some people that are just in the middle, and you have some people that are just trying to make some money and make some careers. But I think Black Lives Matter was started by there was a woman named I met her in Los Angeles, California. She'd been to Toronto. Patrice Cullors, right? She was one of the co-founders, and she was. Her father was in prison, is in prison today. So I know she basically was upset because of the way the police sheriff people would start treating people, in Los Angeles,
mm-hmm.
and then you have other people that were meeting with Hillary, and you know, so it's today's movement. I think we should.
So you think it was more out of the police brutality towards the youth?
Of course, yeah.
Much mm-hmm. like Batsy, the one that, in Canada that was
Black Action Defense Committee, right?
Dudley Law.
Right. The police have always been the organizing us in terms of since slavery. I mean, it's like the police are part of the state, and the state's job is to criminalize people, and that's in any society. Police are, you go to the Caribbean, you go to Europe, it's the state that is coming down on people in any society.
I think Black. I have the greatest respect for movements like Occupy and Black Lives Matter. I think they're to be commended for their courage, and I think they're certainly showing their smarts, and I hope they accomplish their goals. And I think that the majority of Canadians specifically are pulling for them, because a lot of the injustices that they want to address are
mm-hmm.
need to be addressed.
And they're all youth-led movements.
Well, most social movements are youth-led. They start in the universities and amongst middle-class college students. And that started back, you know, if you look at the French Revolution and the Chinese Revolution and the Cuban Revolution and South
right.
Africa, it always begins with young college students and middle class. And they sort of take up the torch, and then other people fall in along with them to support them. So I'm sure that Black Lives Matter has some insincere people, but tell me an organization that doesn't.
Correct. As far as civil rights movement, from the 60s to today, what do you think are the positives and the advancements?
Well, as Otis said, we're still alive. In 60, it was 66 when I traveled to by bus to a little place called Soberton, Georgia. And we got out. This was 2 years after the Civil Rights Act was passed. There was a bunch of us, about three Black kids and about 20 white kids. And we went into the restaurant there in Soberton. And we were sitting there for about half an hour before we realized that either the place had closed and they accidentally left the door open, or they weren't serving us. So we walked back to the bus, and on the way back to the bus, we found that there was, as we looked over our shoulder, there was a group of about 24 white men with baseball bats and pieces of wood coming after us.
Mm-hmm.
I guess in the early days, that would have been the end of us. But in this case, actually, the police intervened. And I think the only reason the police intervened is that because it no longer was legal or acceptable to burn and shoot and stab civil rights workers.
Okay.
And I think that the Civil Rights Act had a lot to do with that. It bringing that to the consciousness, the Rosa Parks and the people that came even before her turned the tide in terms of America's attitude towards civil rights, whether it be toward Blacks or Chinese or Chicanos or women. So I think there have been a lot of changes to the better, certainly not enough.
And today, the civil rights movement, to how powerful is the dialogue?
There is, I brought a couple of newspapers. There's a group called the African People's Socialist Party. They have a newspaper. They have radio the internet radio. I work with them. You have the Black Left group. They have some information I can share with you. We still have the NAACP is still there. We have Black Lives Matter. We have a movement, mm-hmm. but I think we, you know, some people believe you need a centralized leadership. So we don't really have the centralized leadership, but we have movements all over the country and all over the world.
Right.
And people are fed up because, I mean, you can only take so many beatings before you take action. But I think that Black people, not only in North America but around the world, are under attack, and they are organizing, but it's sort of scattered. You know what I mean?
And you think that is happening today? All of the Black people all around the world are currently under attack.
I think so. Yes.
Is this a movement that's coming back from the 60s?
I don't think it ever changed. I mean, Donald Trump is just basically, first of all, Trump, the whole Trump thing, there's a split in society. You have a lot of white folks that are not down with Trump.
Right.
And you have some that are, and it's the same thing in France with Le Pen, in Germany, you have, a group of people that want to crush Black people, and you have a group of people that want to, it's not a question of loving somebody, but they understand that, hey man, you can't just fight all the time. You know,
is this a resurgence or is it a continuation of the same?
I think it's a continuation of the same thing. Donald Trump is a, I mean, the mere fact that he...
The lightning rod.
Yeah. And he's so megalomaniac and crazy. Half the stuff he's saying he's going to do, I don't think he's going to be able to do because, you know, it's just... It's too far. It's just lunatic stuff.
Which brings you back to the importance of the civil rights movement then and now. How important is it to continue that dialogue and to press upon people the importance of being more committed to it?
You can't impress upon people. You can't impress commitment. Commitment is either there or it's not.
Mm-hmm. It also depends who's been influenced, who's suffering from it.
Yeah, that's true. I define, I sort of look at this current state of affairs as sort of more of a worldly view. Everyone is prejudiced. I don't like bald people. Everyone has something that they don't like. Racism is a different matter. Racism is institutionalized prejudice.
Mm-hmm.
And I think for a while there, the institutions backed off and that there was less racism in the higher hallways of power. I think that's resurging back. I think Mr. Trump has a lot to do with that. But it was there all along anyway, sort of lurking in the closets. Do we need more? Do we need Martin Luther King's now? And do we need Malcolm X's? Yes, we always need those people. Do we need Angela Davis's? Yes, we always need those people. Those people are sort of the thermometers of our society. And they help to not only vocalize the problems that we're having, some of which are just human problems. But some of them are social problems that can be more easily addressed. Prejudice, unfortunately, everyone has, and mm-hmm. that will never be addressed completely or relied. Actually, we're sort of hardwired from the time that we were all living in caves. We need more leaders. We need educated, committed, vocal, young folks mostly, to bring to society's attention the problems that are not only just civil problems, but human problems and environmental problems.
Okay. Well, gentlemen, I'd love to continue this discussion perhaps in upcoming episodes and love to have you back. We've run out of time, but we'd like to thank you for being on Conflict Radio.
Thank you, Sandy.